Welcome to the Permaculture for the Future podcast. I'm your host, Josh Robinson. The world is full of negative news, and the planet seems to be in an ecological crisis. And this can be downright disheartening and disenfranchising because we feel that there's nothing that each one of us can do as an individual that can make any difference. Well, I'm here to provide a different perspective, to tell a new story. The Permaculture for the Future podcast is all about spreading positive and impactful stories, tips, and ways that each one of us can transition into a regenerative lifestyle where we can make an ecological impact. We talk about simple ways to make lifestyle changes as we interview authors, teachers, and other folks that are collectively healing ourselves and the planet. So if you want to make an ecological impact, stick around because this podcast is for you. Welcome to episode 15 of the Permaculture for the Future podcast. I'm your host, Josh Robinson. And on today's show, we have a really special guest coming all the way from Canada. We're going to be talking to Rob Avis of Verge Permaculture about how to prepare for future catastrophes, including this current pandemic that many of us are already experiencing. But before we jump into that, I wanted to let you all know about a special opportunity that we're providing here at the Permaculture for the Future podcast and the San Diego Sustainable Living Institute. Now, I've been teaching permaculture for over 15 years, and I see the power and the beauty and the potential in this information, in transforming the place around us into something that is ecological, that is bountiful, that is productive, that provides livelihoods, right? Permaculture is an incredibly powerful tool. And for the first time in the 15 years that I've been teaching this, we've been put into a position where we can't actually meet in person. Now, I love the in-person experiences of teaching this to other people, but for our spring design course, which was slated to start in just a few weeks here, we're having to make some adjustments. And so for the first time, we're going to be offering an online permaculture design course. Now, we want this to be the most amazing experience that we've ever offered. And I think we could do that even in an online realm. I think we could actually pack in more information that we would even be able to do in the in-person time, right? And what we want to also make this affordable and open for as many people as possible. So we're going to be offering a really highly discounted course. Our normal courses cost about $1,200. But we're going to be able to offer that for about half the cost, right? So 50%. So if you want to jump on this opportunity, jump over to the show notes page at permacultureforthefuture.com/episode15, and you'll find more information about the design course. All right. Well, I'll catch you all at the end. And just a second, we're going to be starting to have our conversation with Rob. Now, Rob is a really amazing guy, and I had so much fun talking to him about permaculture. Now, he has over 15 years combined experience in engineering, project management, ecological design, and sustainable technologies. Rob co-owns Adaptive Habitat, a unique and leading-edge property design and management company in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Now, as a skilled professional engineer, he offers a depth of practical experience in building science and appropriate technology, such as solar, wind, combined heat and power, as well as rainwater harvesting, agroecology, ecosystem engineering, soil regeneration, and on-site wastewater treatment and septic design. His extensive project management experience includes site analysis, technical design, cost estimating and scheduling through to commissioning and construction. Now, Rob holds a Bachelor's of Science in Mechanical Engineering from the University of Alberta and has interned at the Folk Center for Renewable Energy in Denmark and has co-founded Verge Permaculture in 2008 which is now an internationally recognized and award-winning regenerative design consulting and education center. And Rob's also offering a online permaculture design course as well. So if you love what he's saying, you know, jump over and look at that opportunity as well. We need more people out there in the field practicing these kinds of things. And I know a lot of people resonate with a lot of different voices. So take your pick. There's so many opportunities out there. The important thing is, let's do this. All right. Now, without further ado, here's Rob. All right. Well, welcome, Rob, to the Permaculture for the Future podcast. I'm so excited to have you on as a guest today. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while, and the circumstances around the coronavirus just kind of got me thinking around all of these, you know, big issues that we're dealing with. And I thought we could talk a little bit around those areas. Now, for people that are just tuning in and maybe aren't familiar with some of your work, do you want to give a bit of a background about who you are and some of the work that you do?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Rob Avis, and I run two companies up here in Calgary. So we have a consulting branch called Adaptive Habitat, and I have an education company called Verge Permaculture. We've been teaching for around 10 years. Before that, though, I was working in the oil and gas industry as a pipeline engineer. Both my wife and I are mechanical engineers, and we were the folks that made sure that natural gas and oil got to the refineries so that they could produce diesel and gasoline. And I had a very interesting moment as an engineer in the oil and gas industry when one day I was contemplating one of the next decisions I had to make as a project manager, where I was going to be cutting down a massive swath of forest in order to bring in a gas pipeline. And I felt really conflicted by it because on one hand, I was using the product as a consumer. So I couldn't really criticize the industry that I was supporting as a consumer. But at the same time, it kind of struck me as not a very progressive thing to do. And so that very moment, I got Jeff Lawton's video, Greening the Desert. I took out my calculator, calculated out as an engineer, I'm a bit of a nerd. I calculated out how many hours of life energy I had on this planet. We all live for about 600,000 to 700,000 hours. And I asked myself, is this the legacy or how I want to finish my life? Do I want to maintain status quo or do I want to do something different? Like this guy has done by greening the Dead Sea Valley or portion of it anyways. And called my wife up and decided that time to quit our jobs. And so we traveled the world and retooled our career and started Verge, which I just mentioned, and taught over 600 grads over the last 10 years and thousands of other students in other programs that we teach right across Canada and the United States. And yeah, here we are today.
Excellent. I mean, you've been somebody that's had kind of an interesting background, because I don't think a lot of people that come into permaculture come into it either from like, you know, one, an engineering background, or somebody that's actually worked in the oil and gas industry. And a lot of people will come into that situation and just want to criticize like that is the problem. But all of these problems are really derived from people that are just trying to make a living and kind of do this. And until we all begin to open our eyes and understand that there are these other possibilities, we don't really know any better. And I think you have a really interesting outlook on some of these. And how would you say that being in that field has really put into focus some of the things that you're working on now within the permaculture realm?
Oh man, that's a great question, because I think about it every day. And I'm going to throw a couple numbers down at you just to kind of put this in perspective. But when people criticize oil and gas, they do so without really understanding what it is that they're saying. Most of our population has a very little limited understanding of energy at all. And it's because energy gets translated for the average person, it's in, you know, dollars per gallon or dollars per liter. And so we don't really go much further than like thinking about what that liter actually does for us. But a barrel of oil is about a 50 gallon drum, about 200 liters of fossil fuel. And one barrel of oil has the equivalent of about 25,000 man hours of labor in it. So if you take a barrel of oil at $50, and it's much less than that right now, $20, let's just say, but at $50, and you divide it by 25,000 hours, so dollars per hour employed, and then you look at the minimum wage in your state, what you'll realize is that we're all hyper-dependent on energy slaves. In fact, most North Americans have about 125 energy slaves working for us 24/7. And so what's really important to note about that is that 100 years ago, when we started developing the Saudi oil fields, we could invest one barrel of oil and get between 1,000 and 20,000 barrels of oil out of the ground. The typical shale oil or shale gas formation now yields about four to six barrels of oil for every barrel we invest. And so if we compare that to renewables, which is the obvious next question people would be asking, a solar panel has about a similar 6-to-1 return on investment. So the microphone you're using, the computer that we're both leveraging, the internet network that uses enormous amounts of energy, are all the output of having a seemingly endless supply of slaves working for us behind the scenes for fractions of a cent. And this ties into permaculture, because one of the things that permaculture aims to do is to generate or capture real-time energy, solar energy, to create food, energy, shelter, water, fiber, pharmaceuticals, all of the above. And so I have a theory that I think is becoming my life's purpose, which is that you cannot have a regenerative agriculture. Agriculture is the foundation of civilization, so everything that we need, basically, almost, unless the products coming out of that system have a net positive energy output. So what do I mean by that? The current calorie of food that we consume, which is actually a kilocalorie, the units presented on the back of a piece of packaging, consumes 10 calories, kilocalories of hydrocarbon for every kilocalorie of food we consume. In the 1940s, we could put 1 kilocalorie into the system and get 3 out. And so I think if we stopped looking at regenerative agriculture through all these other lenses and just said, well, what does it mean to have a net positive calorie output? And my theory is that you cannot get there unless you're partnering with ecological services. So as permaculture designers, if we use that as our metric and take out the veganism, take out the omnivorism, take out the carnivorism, and just say, and all the other stuff too, and just say, we're going to measure our success as professionals, as permaculture designers, based upon our ability to figure out what our properties or our client properties want to be, and then measure the energy output that comes as a result through the biomass and the food and all the other stuff that we produce, that's where we need to be if we want to continue to coexist on this planet. Because peak oil will happen at some point, and there's lots of reasons that it can happen. We're going to get into that when we talk about black swans. But that energy piece is what drove me or interested me in permaculture. If we don't want to cut forests down to bring in natural gas and oil, then how do we have to act in order to be able to exist on this planet without having 125 energy slaves working for us 24/7?
Yeah. And rather than just pointing the finger and complaining, what is this alternative that we can present to the rest of the world that wants to do something about this?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, the peak oil has definitely been, I think, a driver for a lot of people. I mean, 15 years ago or whenever, when I first read The Party's Over with Richard Heinberg, and it was kind of a big wake-up call. And a lot of what you're talking about, particularly the energy slaves, is something that I don't think a lot of us really conceptualize or spend much time thinking about. That, you know, our very lifestyle is essentially like we have, you know, a numerous number of slaves just doing all of this work for us. And I think one of the pieces that I notice in something like this coronavirus pandemic is that a lot of the fragile nature of our society really emerges when you start to have a little bit of stress in there. And the other day when we were chatting, we're talking a little bit about, you know, kind of planning for these types of events and looking at the really just the possibility of, you know, these black swan kind of events. Do you want to talk a little bit and get into a little around that?
Yeah, sure. So I think what's really important, first of all, is that, and I think one of the things that permaculture does a really good job of is really defining sphere of influence versus sphere of concern. And so a lot of us find permaculture because we have this, we are awakened or we come across something that kind of expands our sphere of concern. So peak oil, And usually when somebody's first kind of going down that rabbit hole, or it could be food security, or it could be any of the issues that we could spend an hour talking about each one of them for the rest of the year, because there's so many to talk about, usually people shut down at that point. And so when people come to my program, to a permaculture design course, I actually call it the six stages of eco mourning, because they're like going through a mourning process as they kind of release their concerns and then replace them in with kind of strategic or positive actions that they can take, because we bring them back out. We're like, yeah, all this stuff is really important out here, but what do you have control of down here? And so when we're out in the sphere of concern, the most productive thing we can do out there is to start identifying the systems that we depend upon. So energy, water, food, shelter, clothing. Like, I think a lot about living in a cold climate. Like, where are my socks going to come from? Like, that's a sphere of concern for me. And it's like, I got to think about where my fiber is going to come from if I'm not buying cotton socks from the US or Thailand or whatever. And so you identify all these systems that you depend upon. And instead of shutting down and getting depressed or kind of going down the conspiracy hole, and I don't like calling them conspiracies, they're hypotheses, but instead of going too far down that hole, the job of a permaculture designer is to classify each of those systems you depend upon within a range of either fragile, resilient, or anti-fragile. And so anti-fragile is this word that Nassim Taleb coined. I believe it was him. I haven't heard anybody else claim that word. And so that word is kind of foreign to a lot of people and confuses them. And so if you think about shipping wine glasses, the first thing that you'll think about is putting a label on there that says fragile. And so what that means is that that thing inside of that box, that wine glass, is not going to benefit from volatility. And so anti-fragile is the exact opposite. Like, if you were shipping something that was anti-fragile in a box, you would actually put a label on it saying, please apply volatility, shake me, drop me, whatever. And so when systems are fragile, like food, energy, water, shelter, then, and you can identify that, you don't actually need to know that a pandemic is coming. You don't need to know that there's going to be an economic calamity. You don't need to know that peak oil is around the corner. You just need to know that a fragile system is going to respond negatively to any amount of volatility. And when you look at all the systems that we depend on, they all depend upon real-time, just-in-time services. So it's like, we don't put stuff in our warehouses anymore because we don't want to pay for the inventory. We don't store water because there's always water coming in pressurized pipes off the street, unless you live in California a couple of years ago and the pipes stopped flowing. We don't worry about where our energy comes from because it's made just as we need it. And so all of these systems are fragile, and that means that it exposes us to something like this pandemic, but it could be something way less or way more benign that can, you know, upset the apple cart, so to speak. And so a lot of what Mollison was trying to get across was, what are the things that we can do just outside our backyard or in our back 40 on a rural property that manage our supply chains in such a way that either on our own property or within the greater community of people around us, in such a way that when one of these things happens, the system actually benefits from it. And I'll give you an example of it. So you teach permaculture design, and I suspect you do consulting as well. And I suspect that you're having the same situation happen to you right now that I am. I have sales calls lined up for the next 3 weeks. I have people signing up for our courses faster than they've ever done in the past, ever. And so I'm having these insights right now. Like, in the good times, you and I grow our food, we eat well, we're surrounded by incredible people, we make enough to get by when you're in the permaculture space, at least thus far. But then when your president or my prime minister shuts the economy down, we can't keep up. And so our businesses are what Taleb would call, Nassim Taleb, asymmetric. So they thrive in the time when things are bad, and they're pretty good. They're okay. They're pretty good in times when times are good. And that's the exact type of business you want to be in, because our businesses are benefiting from volatility. And the reason that the listener might be interested in that is, as you're stuck at home in your quarantine because your job has been like finished or you've been laid off or whatever, and you're thinking about how to retool your life, you should be taking one of Josh's courses and training, like investing in training right now, so that when you come off the back end, less than 3% of the world grows food now, or at least in North America. You know, we are so specialized that we cannot creatively or positively, most of us can't positively pivot in this type of a situation. So what you do is super important for your bioregion.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thought. It's something I haven't really kind of put to words in thinking about, you know, the opposite of the fragile, the anti-fragile piece, but looking at kind of these skills and, you know, like you're saying, right now with this pandemic, there has essentially been just this huge upsurge of interest in a lot of this activity, because I feel like, you know, people are realizing that whatever that skill set that they had beforehand really isn't relevant. And that the closer that we get back down to these like basic necessities, you know, by nature are almost going to be like these more anti-fragile components that we could be working in. So that's a interesting insight as we look into even where to focus your work energy and moving away from even looking at jobs that are going to be towards, you know, this anti-fragile area, the fragile area, but moving towards the anti-fragile thing. It's like the closer we can get back to maybe our basic needs and those skills related to that are still going to always be in demand.
Totally.
Yeah. So what else are you kind of seeing in terms of like what's been playing out? I mean, here in Southern California, it's been kind of interesting to watch. And most people I've talked to, it's been kind of a similar story. Now you're up in Canada. What have been your experiences as this has been kind of rolled out? And it seems like in a very similar timeline to, I think, what we've been experiencing. I mean, we've been essentially quarantined here for about a month, you know, as we're chatting today. Pretty sure I remember that Canada was kind of closing down a lot of its markets and whatnot around that same time.
Yeah, it's been similar. I think Canada was maybe a little bit more aggressive earlier on. And so it's been really interesting to kind of observe the types of phone calls that I'm getting and the amount of anxiety that people have. I think a lot of people are going to come out of this with some variation of PTSD. You know, the words that are being floated around right now, which are really concerning, I've got a few highly intelligent economists in my life. They're not talking about the rebuild. They're talking about the reset. And like really kind of wrapping your head around what that means, like what a reset looks like, is but kind of what I've been contemplating a lot of. And the way I understand it is that there's just not, I mean, this is an interesting thing. I just found out about the states the other day, just to kind of put things in perspective. Numbers can do that sometimes. So when Obama was managing the 2008 crisis, the U.S. raised its debt ceiling to $1 trillion. And so that $1 trillion took, how many years has the U.S. been? It's like 400 and some years, right? Like what's the...
Yeah.
I mean, so it took you guys 400 plus years to basically get to a $1 trillion debt ceiling. In the last 2 weeks, you guys printed $4 trillion, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. And so you really get a sense of the exponential kind of growth of debt. And so that's only going to pay you guys for rent and groceries for the next month or so. Like if you Google, I'll bring it up on my, I'll share my screen with you here. So if you Google Spanish flu chart, you'll get this really interesting image. And there's some really smart people who are kind of starting to talk about the coronavirus through this light. And so this little chart here represents the first wave of the Spanish flu. Okay, so this is deaths per thousand. And then it kind of went on. And then all of a sudden, boom, second wave right here. And it's like 25, so it's five times worse. And then if you kind of keep going on, you end up with this third wave and it's somewhere in the middle. And so like when you start contemplating shutting economies down for 1, 2, 3 quarters, multiple times in 3 years, you know, what gets left behind? And like, how do you even keep all these businesses going? And it starts bringing in some larger kind of philosophical and also kind of economic type questions. So there's a great book called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. And one of the most interesting things in that book, that's one of the last things he says, is it doesn't make any sense that China was buying as much debt from the United States as it has been over the last, 2 or 3 decades. unless you understand how they create military policy. And so the Chinese in the past have done this in the past. And so the guy, the author is basically postulating that they're doing it again, that they will lavish their enemies with gifts for multiple decades in order to make them soft and weak. And then when they get to the end of their cycle, then they'll pounce. And I'm not trying to spawn conspiracy theories by saying this, but it's just interesting that the kind of discourse that's going on right now. And so when you look at the amount of debt that the US has been selling to China, that to me would make me think, well, that's pretty fragile. What happens if they stop wanting to buy that debt anymore? Well, then what are the things that I can do to ensure, because really like permaculture is just a form of insurance in a sense, to ensure myself, my family, and my community that if they stop buying the debt for whatever reason, that I'm not going to starve to death.
Yeah. I mean, that's incredibly important kind of questions. And I think it gets to the heart of, you know, why we're even talking about permaculture today is really this kind of response to various crises. And I think the economic side that you're bringing up there is incredibly important, because right now it's like we're kind of in that, you know, what I consider maybe a triage phase, where like we're feeling the fragile nature of our healthcare system, which triggered a, you know, fragile connection to our healthcare. And that's now rippling into, you know, our economics and rent and bills and everything that we have been essentially relying on for all of our needs. What is that piece going to look like as we move out, you know, a month from now, 2 months, a year, you know, as we start to really kind of reel in from this, you know, effects that we're being built right now, like, you know, all these changes that are happening. But yeah, what does that look like as we move forward? And that's kind of a, you know, a big unknown. But again, you know, like I think if we bring it back to like a permaculture perspective, there's a lot that could be gleaned there. And I think that's a lot why in the permaculture courses, we're talking about things like these alternative economic systems, or, you know, ways to build some redundancy in there that can, you know, synergize very well with whatever the dominant economic system is. Has that been like a focus of yours over the years? And how does that kind of play out in some of the work that you've been doing?
So there's two pieces to that. Number one, in the Great Depression, I believe it was 10% of the urban population starved to death, in spite of the fact that there were enormous amounts of food being produced. And I don't know what the percentage is, but it was well over the 3% of people. Right now, 3% of the population farms, I think. And it was probably like 60 to 80% back then. And if they didn't farm, they lived on a farm. And if they didn't live on a farm, they grew a garden. So like we're in a totally different space now. I think the second thing is that we know that in difficult times, World War II and probably the Depression, but for sure, World War II, everybody knows about the Victory Garden and how, you know, 50% of the food was coming out of backyard gardens. And we also have other kind of stories that we can refer to in places like Russia, when we look at the Dasha system and how, you know, the USSR was never able to feed their population. And as a result of that hardship, people figured it out on their own. Dmitry Orlov's got a great book called The Five Stages of Collapse that kind of outlines the upside of down, so to speak. So I think, like, what does it look like, and why you're so important and permaculture and these courses that we're both teaching is so important is we have a lifetime worth of retraining ahead of us. Like we have to continually learn ourselves, because we're figuring, like, permaculture is only 30 years old. Like, there's a lot still to learn. But then as we're learning, we also have to be disseminating that knowledge, because we've got to bring that 3% back up to some number that will bring stability back to some of our basic supply chains that are rapidly eroding because they're so global in nature. In terms of where the rubber hits the road, a lot of people come to these programs and think, oh yeah, I'm going to take this course. I'm going to be self-sufficient. I'm going to do everything for myself. And you and I both know that that's totally BS. And so the piece that needs to be emphasized, I think, more than anything else, because anybody can pick up a book on how to garden, and there's lots of different ways to do it, and a lot of them are great. The piece that I think is more important than even the gardening is the community group. And so one of the first things that we designed and built, not having a farm when we first started, was the Calgary Permaculture Guild, which is still going today. It's 10 years old. We have close to 100 members. We meet every month for a potluck. We start every potluck with a 30-minute market to kind of get the idea of people producing and wanting to bring stuff to the market and sell with each other. My son has a little ketchup business that he produces ketchup and sells to people. And so we're trying to get that entrepreneurial spirit in his mind. So if he wants money, he has to earn it. And he's got regular customers. It's awesome. You can't get much better homeschooling than that. And so, but as in the same way that my business is getting a lot of requests right now, the Calgary Permaculture Group is growing. So we had a virtual Permi Drinks last week. And we had, I think, over 100 people show up from right across the country, actually, to listen to a talk on gardening. And so within these groups, there's lots of alternative currency models. Let's is one of them. We haven't quite got to that stage yet, but I think it's not far off where you start creating alternative currencies amongst these groups of individuals. And there's a really great TED talk by a guy named Bernard Lyotard, who was the architect of the euro. And he talks about how alternative currencies have been used in history. Like Switzerland instituted their own local currency during World War II, which is what allowed a lot of their big companies to continue to operate because they had a currency amongst the companies as opposed to Swiss francs. And so in the same way that a monocrop of canola or corn or wheat has all these ecological potholes or grenades associated with it because it's just not, doesn't make any sense to have a monoculture, we have a monoculture of money. We have a monoculture of culture. Like we go to movie theaters to listen to, we basically have allowed a whole entity, a whole region of North America, Hollywood, to tell our story. We don't have a verbal tradition anymore where we tell our own stories in groups. We don't do talent shows and we don't do dances anymore. Like we've outsourced our entertainment. And so these community groups allow us to connect at that level again, where we can play guitar in a circle or have a drum circle or share food together, produce for each other, horse trade, and have alternative currencies so that we meet our needs. And folks in your neck of the woods are starting to do this, which I suspect that they are. One of the best games that you can do in a time like this in a community group is a needs and yields circle. Have you ever done that?
I don't necessarily know it by that, but I think I understand the concept, and it's something we've definitely included in gatherings.
Like the string game where you throw strings at each other and create a web of resilience?
I know it as the web of connection.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. All right. If you go around the circle and you ask people to kind of what they yield or what they need, but mostly, most importantly, what they yield, you realize that you can build an entirely new civilization with the electrician and the engineer and the plumber and the carpenter and the gardener, and like all the skills are represented there. And the reason these people aren't communicating with each other is because we're all waiting for somebody to show up with American dollars versus just creating an alternative mechanism to exchange value.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of people, when you start getting into alternative currencies and other ways of exchange, get a little bit confused or maybe even fearful about, like, well, this is something I'm not familiar with, but, or it's very complicated, or why would I need to do that when we have dollars? But I think the really important part to get across is it's not, we know that the strength, say, of an ecosystem is really determined by the number of connections, of beneficial connections that are linking all of those elements together. And I think, you know, when you start to look at our financial and economic systems, it really functions in a lot of the same ways. I mean, you talk to a banker and they're talking about, you know, diversifying your portfolio and this and that. And I think it's coming back to a lot of these like very similar concepts where what we're looking at is to be able to meet our needs in a way that's going to, you know, benefit, you know, not only us, but our local community. And there's a lot of different ways that we can do that, such as, you know, just working on a barter system or trade system like you were talking about. And I've often looked at, you know, I love looking at Google Earth and thinking of, you know, some sort of app, because like, you know, when we're talking about permaculture, oftentimes we are talking about these things where maybe you blow up a little neighborhood map. And you start looking at each individual household there. And like you're saying, you identify what the skills or the needs of a, you know, the residents are there, you're going to find that you have doctors, you have plumbers, you have like all of these skills and resources that are right there. And, you know, if you're somebody of value, then you should also be developing your own skill set. But then there's this opportunity to really, you know, meet our basic needs at that local level. And those things don't require the financial system. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity. And it's not just that. And I feel like there's so many different avenues that we can go to diversify our, you know, economics and financial kind of needs, right? I mean, one, just reducing the amount of money that we need to live, or, you know, there's so many different ways to go there.
Totally. And so I hear exactly what you're saying on the front end of that comment, which is like, why do we even need to play around with LET systems or alternative currencies? Here's why. When times are good, it seems super clunky to do this stuff. It's like money is so fast. It has so much velocity. It makes transactions so quick, especially now with like digital currencies and being able to, I mean, I don't pay with my smartphone, but I know a lot of people that do, and you just need to tap your Visa and it's like instantaneous. And that's a lot of GDP growth comes through, which is a whole other conversation. You know, should we even be trying to grow GDP? But anyhow, that's the goal of the current system. And it comes just by increasing the velocity of transactions. So the velocity makes things really easy. And that's why people use money and credit cards and all that stuff. The problem is that these same economists that I've been talking to are saying that we're very likely going to go into a contractionary deflation. And then following that into a hyperinflation. And for most people that haven't studied that, I'm a pretty new student to some of this stuff. And I've been reading about it quite a bit just to kind of prepare myself mentally more than anything else for what could be coming down the pipe. As North Americans, both Americans and Canadians, we are very privileged in the sense that we've both grown up in very stable times. There's always been food. There's always been a job. There's all like, if you work really hard, you can move yourself forward. And there's all these kind of beliefs that we share as neighbors. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to go very far. I mean, you go to Venezuela or Argentina, and, you know, during our lifetimes, people were starving to death in these relatively developed nations because of hyperinflation. You know, it's kind of funny. It's not funny. It's more of a Shakespearean kind of comedy. It's sad, actually. You know, to think that in Venezuela, they weren't able to feed themselves. I mean, you should be able to grow anything 12 months of the year there, and yet people are starving to death. And now you go north, you know, where I live, I've got 100 frost-free days.
Ooh, that's a tough season.
It's a tough season. And that doesn't mean I can't graze for longer. Like, I've got grass grows here longer. So we are definitely a protein-producing region. But it's a lot harder, and you got to start, like, I think one of the best things that could have happened in terms of this coronavirus is that it happened in the wintertime. Like, I've had a lot of time to kind of premeditate how I'm going to manage the coming season and make sure that my family has food on its table, and kind of figure out how I'm going to pivot myself so that I have value to give in that scenario, and how I'm going to teach as many people as I possibly can what I know so that they have a good chance of achieving the same thing. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Sobering.
It's incredibly sobering to really think about this time period that we're in. And like you said, it's something that, being here in North America, I mean, it's been generations since, you know, any one of our families has really experienced, I think, what we're about to. And right now, you know, it feels scary because maybe of this health thing or just not knowing, and you're, you know, a lot of people are out of work, but like, this is going to really translate into some kind of longer term scenarios. And like, how are people preparing for that? And really looking at being of service, being of value in an era where those, you know, work is going to be essentially, I think, at least in the financial sense, potentially a much more difficult approach. You know, I mean, we're already right here in the States, we're seeing unemployment rates that we have never, since really probably the Great Depression, you know, is equal to right now. I know some of these jobs will start to come back online, but I know there's tons of businesses out there that have been heavily impacted to the point where I don't think they are going to come back. And all of the people that were relying on them for work are also going to be out of employment for quite some time. So, you know, given that scenario, and as we're starting to look forward, it's like, yeah, a garden is going to be great in terms of being able to provide for our food needs and nutritional needs. But we still have a lot of other things that, you know, we need to really thrive. So unless like you own your own home outright, I mean, you still have property taxes and other things that you'll be paying, but there's going to be a lot of big changes. And so given that, how are you yourself kind of preparing for that?
I've been taking a lot of time to reflect on that, as I'm sure you have as well. Mm-hmm. And like right now, people like you and I that have spent the better part of the last decade or more thinking about these things. I mean, this is what we've been training for. And so number one, I mentioned it, that I'm repositioning my business so that I have my own kind of air mask on first. Mm-hmm. But number two, I think it's really easy to look at these scenarios and kind of go into prepper mode. And other than making sure that you're sorted, I think we have to be hyper empathetic and ready to lead. And recognize that if the majority of us don't get through this, none of us do. I think that's the gravity of the situation. Like it's not, you know, go off into your bunker with your 2 years supply of food and plant a garden. It's like, no, plant a garden, make sure you got food, and make sure you're teaching everybody you possibly can on how to, and food is the one we keep coming back to, but I live on a farm where there's lots of forest around. And so I want to make sure that I'm meeting all of my neighbors, like coming back to that knees and yields exercise and understanding what equipment they have, what skills they've got that I don't, let them know what skills I have that they don't have, and start organizing and start having these conversations. Let's not wait to have these conversations in 6 months from now. Yes, we've got the social distancing thing to think about, but the biggest concern I have around social distancing is that we stop talking to each other, or we don't meet each other and have these important conversations and coordinate, you know, and make important decisions that are going to have ramifications in 6 months from now. We really have got to be inclusive in our networks and do everything in our power to empower people. Like the seed companies right now are shutting down because they've been oversubscribed.
Yeah.
And it's like, how many people are starting gardens for the first time this year who have no clue how to grow food? And so then the people that know how to grow food can't get the seeds. And it becomes a Shakespearean comedy again, where it's like this like deeply ironic situation where people did the right thing by buying the seeds, but they hadn't done any of the pre-work to understand like what it takes to grow something. Like, do you put the seed in 1 centimeter, 5 centimeters, 6 centimeters? What is a centimeter? Like, what's the tilt of the soil? Like, what's compost? Like, mm-hmm. do I have to irrigate this? Like, all simple things to figure out over 3 or 5 gardening seasons. But now it's like the rubber's hitting the road, and these people are trying to sort this out on the fly, and they might just all fail, or a lot of them might fail. And people are like, you can't grow gardens. Like, I'm not going to do that again.
Yeah.
So we have to give people the knowledge they need to succeed.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I tend to look at that as like looking on the bright side of the situation. This is incredible that we are selling out of seeds essentially continent-wide here. I mean, all of the major seed companies are basically shutting down orders, except for maybe some of the commercial customers. That means that there's a lot of people out there starting gardens. And like you said, for the first time, and that gives me a kind of a lot of optimism. In that one, I think points out again those areas where I think there's showing where potential jobs are, you know, that we could utilize more seed companies and plant related businesses. But at the same time, like we've been talking about this kind of stuff for a long while and trying to get people out there to take responsibility for this planet. Provide some food, provide, you know, start harvesting energy, all that kind of stuff. And now, like, this has been kind of like this moment where people are actually doing it. And what I would like and hope for is that they do have a great experience. And then this continues to be kind of like that, that moment where it just kicked off their lifelong journey down this path. Because, you know, like you said, we have a lot of work ahead of us. And really, this coronavirus is happening at a time in our history where it's like we're hitting some pretty major climate change kind of issues. And I don't think we can forget and not acknowledge that and try to, you know, use this as a moment where it works us into a realm where we're going to be, you know, hopefully not only beginning to address climate change, but at the same time, being able to prepare for what we know are going to be other events that could easily happen. I mean, we get wildfires like crazy around where I'm at. I'm sure you're even getting wildfires up that way, or flooding, or, you know, what's the next catastrophe that could potentially hit a region? And it's like, yeah.
Can't predict it.
No, by its nature.
Yeah. So a crisis is a horrible thing to waste. And I think Holmgren and Mollison said the problem is the solution. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. Like, and that's the piece that in permaculture kind of makes it, I think it was Penny Livingston Stark that said, if we want the world to change, it has to taste better. It has to be more fun and more inclusive. And I think it's easy to listen to all the stuff I just said and like be terrified into doing something. That's the wrong reason. I mean, the reason that you look at the anti-fragility lens and you look at risk is so you don't have to worry about it. It's because you look at your sphere of concern and then you look at what you have the ability to influence, you act on that and know that you did the best that you can. And that beyond a certain dose, you can't do anything. And that's when you kind of have to figure out what spirituality means to you, because there's nothing you can do about an asteroid. So like, don't worry about that. It's like, that's out of your sphere of influence. But there's lots you can do about this pandemic. There's an endless number of things. And the business opportunities, like, not to always make this about money and business, but at the end of the day, right now, everything that the majority of what people need takes money to buy. Mm-hmm. Because we've built the system on that. And so the big risk that I see is that we've destroyed the economic engine. It's like basically being a controlled demolition of the economy, essentially. Mm-hmm. And people have anxiety because we've taken away their ability to earn currency, which is how we buy our basic needs. And so that's where this crisis is presenting an opportunity for systems like permaculture so that we can actually show people how to start to rebuild their supply chains like they did in Cuba, you know, during the special period.
Yeah. Well, and that does seem to be another kind of aspect of, you know, catastrophe, is that it does, you know, put you into kind of like the edge of your, you know, comfort zone or the edge of your experiences and can push you oftentimes into a realm that you might not have been comfortable trying before, but realizing that you are, you know, have like maybe that breakthrough and that you do enjoy something or you pick up a new skill. So there are, you know, these upsides, you know, that are also kind of playing out here. Yeah, there's such a big, big topic with a lot of lessons. And I think, you know, really without knowing where to go, it's like, what can we do but really focus on what we have that control over, which is, I love what you were talking about there in terms of your sphere of influence.
Yeah. And have you seen this note going around by a girl named Katie Lamont?
I don't think I have.
Okay. So I got this. I did a video about it today. And so I think it's great because it kind of hits all the different pieces. And again, not to oversimplify this just with the gardening piece, but anyway, this is what it says. If you believe this virus is spread by human to human, the antidote is building the immune system by eating plants and natural medicines and sitting in nature alone or with your immediate family, soaking up vitamin D and sunshine. If you believe that this virus is symptoms of 5G exposure, then the antidote is sitting in nature, connecting to Mother Nature or Mother Earth, building your immunity with eating plants and natural medicines, and submerge yourself in water and dirt. If you believe that this is all a hoax and you just need to sit back while Q saves us all, then the answer is sitting in nature, build a garden for new earth, commune with God, eat plants and natural medicines, and strengthen your connection and open your channel to the new earth frequency and ascend with her. If you believe the economy is collapsing and authoritarian dictatorship is imminent, the most radical thing you can do in protest is build a garden, release dependency on the system. If you believe that Mother Earth is mad at us for purging the human race, the answer is to go outside, listen, build a garden, and align with her. The answer is always nature, always. We do not have to argue about why. The antidote is obvious. Alignment with nature, with our source of nutrients, Everything we use and needs comes from her. Give thanks, humble, slow down, observe, and listen. Written by Katie Lamont. Like, it doesn't matter what you're, a lot of the discourse happening right now is focusing on why. It doesn't matter. Like, you can't influence why it's happening. It's rolling out. It's like a steam shovel. Like, it's just, it's got this momentum and it's going to keep going until it's not. And so I think the essence of that is, and this really kind of speaks to all the phone calls I've been getting. It's like, whether it's conspiracy theories or whatever, it's like, okay, great. I hear that you're mourning. Now, what's the action that we can take to reduce the concern around that, that you can take action on? And I think that's what's really great about kind of what you guys are doing in San Diego with your company and even this podcast, because this is a fairly new thing for you guys, right?
Yeah, the podcast just started in January this year.
Okay, how's that going?
It's been great. Yeah, weekly show. It's been fun to kind of, I mean, talk about putting yourself in kind of like edge scenarios. Yeah. It was kind of like the edge of my comfort zone, but I've been really enjoying this process of just connecting with other people, talking with it. And really, you know, we need to hear stories that I think are uplifting and positive and showing that there is this other possibility. And that was really the focus of the show, was to just share and hopefully inspire other people to begin to take action and take those first steps of doing something. Well, I mean, just the last thought on that is that time of waiting to do something is really over. Like, we need action from huge quantities of people, and we need folks like yourselves that are out there, you know, teaching this to everybody that they know, and, you know, all these little groups that are, you know, forming and doing work. It's incredible. And the movement has just blown up over the last 20, well, really the last, you know, 5-10 years. I mean, it's been incredible to watch these changes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Do you know Jordan Peterson?
I do.
Have you seen his stuff?
Yeah.
So you either love him or hate him, but he made a comment, which I think is hyper relevant to this podcast, but also this kind of medium in general. And I think why it's so important, you said, to change the story, basically, that's what you're insinuating, is like, when you're talking about the monoculture of Hollywood and this kind of unified one place where we get all of our stories from, his point was that podcasts, long form conversations, YouTube videos is a more important technology than the Gutenberg press, because it allows us to capture our story back. And like, you know, you look at the 24-hour news cycle, and they get paid to sell advertising. And they know that fear is the most potent thing to keep people in attention. And so they have a conflict of interest to kind of keep the narrative super negative. And so you if you just watch the news cycle, you'll believe that the world is constantly burning and none of the good stories actually get out. And in fact, Taleb talks about how one negative event, in order to erase one negative event in your mind, you have to consume 10 positive ones, because our minds are so hardwired to that negativity. Mm-hmm. And so, like, positive podcasts and YouTube videos are super, super important. And so I find this form of communication really, really interesting. And the other cool thing about podcasts is that people can listen to it while they're doing work. Mm-hmm. And so as the growing season is going along, you know, one of the things that I think would make a really big difference is actually kind of having these things playing in the background as you are out in your garden and listening to these stories from around the world. I think it's really powerful.
Yeah, fully. I mean, just to immerse in kind of, you know, some positive experiences, and really, you know, these are opportunities to learn and realize that world that we are all wanting, that is, you know, full of life and diversity, and it's just getting better and better, is there if we can just make those connections and, you know, connect with our communities. It's like, we have all of the resources, we have all the technology that we need. It's all right there. And, you know, here's that opportunity to kind of realize and come into that being of like, okay, let's make it happen wherever you're at. And here's, you know, Rob Avis that's doing that in Canada, or, you know, here's this other, you know, person that's doing it elsewhere.
Totally.
Well,
so Rob, go ahead. I was going to ask you how you pivoted your, like, what you're offering right now as a result of this down in San Diego.
Well, I have a couple businesses. One is my landscaping business. And yep. I would say that, you know, we have everything from clients that are more like residential to farms, some maintenance in those, and those are just kind of continued on. Been trying to pivot that side of the business into some online, you know, consultations or, you know, garden build kind of areas, because I think a lot of people are interested in gardens. And then on the education side, it's been, you know, just like you said, it's blowing up. I mean, our email list has grown 50% in essentially 2 weeks. You know, like just by putting out information that people are seeing of value.
Right. So
like, you know, the big one here was, you know, when people are freaking out about the food and where they're going to get food from, and realizing like, oh, there's farmers markets are shutting down, grocery stores are out of food. We put together a little resource that just listed where the local farms were and how to purchase their food.
Right.
And that alone got shared, I don't know, almost 40,000 times.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Like, I mean, just showing the demand of like, okay, our basic needs. And then that became the way to connect with people through webinars or, you know, other ways of learning how to garden.
Cool. That's great.
Yeah.
That's really awesome.
Now, I know you got some time constraints here. Do you have any final thoughts or anything that you wanted to convey to listeners?
I think you nailed it. I think this is a huge opportunity. And in spite of the fact that we've got to stay socially isolated, right now is the time to be having conversations with your neighbors and trying to do that inventory with regards to the skill sets in your neighborhood. And not just skills, but I mean, you've probably heard of the 8 forms of capital from Appleseed Permaculture, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I would link to that in your show notes, because I mean, the essence here is that there's a lot of emphasis being placed on the financial capital. But what Ethan Rowland and Gregory Landua really kind of nailed was this idea of the fact that capital is like our balance sheets are far more complex than just how much money is in our bank account or how many houses we own or cars. It's, you know, there's intellectual capital and spiritual capital, social capital, material capital, financial capital, which is the one everybody's focusing on, living capital, cultural capital, and experiential capital. And so, like, just to pick up a couple of these for people to think about, I mean, right now, if you're going and walking around your community, you know, I would be paying attention to where there's edible trees that aren't being harvested, and can you learn how to graft them or propagate them? You know, cultural capital, like how do we start, even though we have to be far apart from each other, like what are the social gatherings that we can do through Zoom or whatever that get people starting to talk about these types of things? Our ability to pivot as a group of individuals is going to be based upon our ability to actually find creative solutions to reconnect with each other and start planning. And I think it can feel weird for people to have these conversations. Like, I think you have to go to the dark stuff a little bit and say, like, here's the realm of possibility. Like, it's not impossible to believe that we could be in a deflationary contraction and then hyperinflation. Let's hope that that doesn't happen. But like, as an engineer, when we're doing risk analysis, we kind of have to kind of paint the whole spectrum out. And then once you can kind of understand what that spectrum looks like, it's like, well, what are the things that are true in a deflationary contraction or hyperinflation? Like, how did people in the past deal with this? How did they get through it? What were the successful strategies that people employed? And those are the types of conversations to be having with your family at the very least, and hopefully with your community. And if there is a local permaculture community group, you know, get involved with that. Start meeting up online with folks that are having positive conversations, and then guard yourself against the negative ones. I know we talked about some negative stuff in this call, but it is so easy. Like, the ganglia in our head is so attracted to the scary messages that it can overwhelm you. And what's really interesting about that, there's a great book by a guy named David Rock called Your Brain at Work. And he really outlines this extremely well, which is that if you're in fear and you can't get out of it, then the prefrontal cortex in your brain will not work. And so we're not running away from saber-toothed tigers right now. we're dealing with something far more difficult. And it requires the gray matter on the front part of your brain to be able to sort this out. Mm-hmm. And so if you're listening to this anywhere else outside of San Diego, across the US, across Canada, find your local permaculture group, find your local permaculture practitioner, figure out a value proposition that works so that you guys can work together. It doesn't always have to be money. There's lots of, everybody has value, and start planning. Yeah. Step up, put your hand up and lead, because that's what's needed. And you know what? If you go to all that effort and this all blows over and it's no big deal, then you'll just end up having some great pizza probably. You know, like there's really no downside to it. You've got all this extra time anyways, but the upside is exponential. So I think that's the thing here. There's lots of upside. If you start acting, there's very little downside.
I think that is so important to really, to put into perspective. I thank you for bringing that up. Now, if people want to get in touch with you and perhaps they're interested in some of the classes that you're doing, what would be the best place for them to find out more about the work that you're doing?
So after all the consulting work that we've done, we actually put together open source tools that you can get for free and anybody can use them. And so if you go to vergepermaculture.ca, we have a little button on the front page called Design the Property of Your Dreams. And this design tool fits within Google Earth Pro. And it basically asks you all the questions that I would ask in a consultancy. And Google Earth Pro is great because you only need to have four buttons in it. And it's pretty much all the functionality that anybody would ever need. It gives you areas and lengths. You can do data overlay and bring in images. And so if you've got some spare time and you want to start designing the property of your dreams and managing your risk, like we've been talking about, put that gray matter to use, and it's free, it's open source. So get involved with that, and that's a great place to start.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Rob. I so appreciate you taking the time here to chat with us. I hope to talk with you sometime here in the future about, you know, ongoing, you know, permaculture topics and whatnot. But in the meantime, thank you. Well, that wraps up today's episode. I hope you got some value out of it. I know I did. There were so many great concepts here that we got to talk about here. A few that are really coming to mind here are really thinking about your sphere of influence versus your sphere of concern, right? So what are those things that you can actually influence versus those that you're concerned about? And then looking at that through this lens of focusing on the systems that you depend on, right? So if we start to look at this from a fragile versus anti-fragile and resilient system kind of analysis, you realize that there's a lot that we can do when it comes to preparing for future catastrophes. All right. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, we are offering for the first time an online permaculture design course. Now, this is going to be a great experience filled with webinars and pre-recorded presentations and videos. There's going to be lots of question and answer that could be done completely live. And there's going to be the ability to connect with your peers via social media and other ways that we're creating connection and groups. So if you want to learn more about that and to get today's show notes, come on over to permacultureforthefuture.com/episode15, and you'll find out all of the details, as well as looking at the links that Rob mentioned in the conversation today. Now, I also just want to have a big shout out to everybody that's gone over to iTunes and wherever you're getting your podcast and have left us feedback. It's been awesome. I love hearing from everybody. This is a great way of getting this information out there and ensuring that more and more people can hear it. So just know that I read all of the comments that are out there, and I'd love to respond to those if I know who they are. All right, so we'll see you next week. In the meantime, get out there and do some good.